I'm really pleased to be here. I'm very sympathetic with lots of things that are in the manifesto. Actually, a lot of my, you know, my own thoughts and views are actually embodied already in the manifesto. So what I wanted to do was actually to just elaborate on four themes that I read in there, say how well I think the manifesto treats them, in fact, and then we can come back and debate these things at length. And I have to say, I'm so delighted to sort of be here where John Urry's work is being discussed, and even Gramsci, you know, as a sociologist, it's sweet to my ears to hear Keynes and, you know, all of these people as part of our discussion. I mean, I'm a sociologist of technology. I've spent many decades thinking about how technology affects, you know, people's experience of work, of home, of interaction, all of these things. And I've written about what I call our schizophrenic or paradoxical attitude towards technology, that there's this widespread perception, if you like, that digitalization has speeded up life, that everyone feels time pressured, very short of time, very busy, and yet we look to technologies all the time to solve these problems, to do things, as you said, simultaneously. So on the one hand, we look to an array of technologies like self-tracking apps, calendars, digital assistants like Alexa and Siri, all of these things to make our lives better by making us more efficient, allowing us to do many more things and faster. And on the other hand, there's this heated discussion that really blames technology for lots of these problems. You know, blames technology for us being tethered 24/7 to our phones, that we don't speak to each other enough, that we can't sleep, that we live with constant interruptions. There's what we call in social science a kind of moral panic, really, about digital addiction. And I spend a lot of my time trying to counter this kind of popular notion that somehow technology is simply to blame for all these ills, that we're somehow just hostages to technology. And so I was very glad when I read the manifesto, because it really does avoid a crude technological determinism of this sort. It contains, in my view, a very nuanced understanding, really, of the effects of information and communication. So I keep looking to the group. You know, it really does contain a very nuanced, I think, engagement with the effects of information and communication technology on our lives. And I know from kind of studying how technology affects us that the effects of technology are rarely straightforward, that they're basically contradictory, and they very much depend on the context and the culture within those within which those technologies emerge and how they're used. And at the heart of this problem, as the manifesto states very clearly, at the heart of the problem is that we live in a culture of optimization. Now, this culture, as various people have already said, values efficiency and busyness. And this culture, as we heard at the beginning, was very long in the making, is part of our notion of kind of modernity. And we just see it as natural now. It's completely taken for granted. And this particular philosophy of time, it seems to me, views time as a resource that must be measured and mastered, somehow according to an accountant's view of time, that time optimization is how we should value time. And I think this is rarely questioned, and Rebalance is precisely trying to address this. And this philosophy of time is actually now completely internalized into our identities, it seems, is part of us, part of how we value ourselves, which is why there are hundreds and hundreds of productivity apps, all aimed at convincing us that somehow we as individuals, rather than society as a whole, can gain control of our time. And I think it's been assumed, and this is my second point, that this is the only way to work and live. This is the only way we can organize our working lives, our home lives. And I think what's really interesting is how much resistance we're now seeing to this traditional hyper-driven work culture. And this is precisely, I think, what the manifesto is reflecting. I'm sure some of you have been following Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter and the recent edict that his employees return to the office 5 days a week and embrace a hardcore, I love this, a hardcore work ethic of very long hours and high intensity. And what he didn't expect is that hundreds of workers just said no and resigned. So I think that it's interesting that even in Silicon Valley, there are lots of workers who are now rejecting what's called in the manifesto meaningless mobility. Journalists ring me all the time because I'm a worker. I'm mainly known as a sociologist of work and employment. And so they ring me all the time and ask me about the future of the office, as if I know the answer to the question, what's the future of the office? I mean, I've spent my whole life dealing with the question of, you know, how is technology affecting work? How many jobs will there be? And we can sort of talk about that at length. But I have to say, with all of these things, I always say we don't know because we're in a period of transition, actually. And I do think that the COVID experience has been, very critical. And certainly in the two workplaces where I work at the moment, one is the London School of Economics, and one is at the Alan Turing Institute, also in London. There's now a tacit understanding that people will come into work 3 days a week. It somehow emerged over this time. There is no expectation anymore that people come in 5 days a week. And this seems to me a huge shift in behavior. And we don't know how this is going to fall out in the long term, but I think it is a sort of critical moment and a very good time to think about these issues. It's exactly the right moment, it seems to me, for a manifesto that talks about making mobility meaningful for people, because actually that's what everybody's sort of thinking about in terms of this business about, how much are we going to be in the office? How much are we going to be at home? What's the hybridity going to look like? We have endless debates within the Turing Institute, I have to say, about the future of Zoom, how much conferences are going to be, like this one, which is wonderful and it's great to be here and one can have meals and debate and all of these things, or how much, you know, we're going to fall back into this habitual Zoom business. And I have to say, at the last meeting of the Turing Institute, all of the young people, as I can now call it, and certainly the graduate students all said that they hated Zoom because actually going to conferences was where they networked, where they met people, where they found patrons, that it was absolutely hopeless in terms of career development to have a future of Zooms. Okay, let me go on to my third point, which is the proposal that care should be the core value in transport policies. And it seems to me that the COVID period has exposed clearly again which workers are core to the functioning of society and which aren't. And even in Tory Britain, there was much discussion of so-called essential workers. You know, who were the workers who had to keep moving to provide essential services? They were, amongst them, they had much higher death rates, of course, compared to people, middle-class people who could be at home and have things delivered. And so I'm very keen on care being central. As a feminist, of course, I've spent, decades talking about the fact that unproductive work, so-called unproductive work of housework and care work needs to be revalued, needs to be put at the center of society. And so I very much like the manifesto's statement that, to quote, putting care at the center means recognizing our weaknesses and interdependencies. I like that very much. I mean, I guess I was just thinking this morning that what I might add to care would be repair, actually. And again, we can come back to this in the discussion, but certainly in my technology circles, and I just got a new Apple phone. So this was very, I always go into the Apple shop and say, I'm happy with this old phone. I don't want a new phone. I'm endlessly told, I'm sorry, my dear. The geniuses, as they're called, the geniuses at the Apple bar, as they call themselves, which I love, say to me, this phone is 4 years old, as if, I say, well, my washing machine's 12 years old. What is this with 4 years old? Anyway, literally, I go into my guys, if I may say so, at the LSE and the tech thing. They just say, Judy, you've got to get a new phone, So it's quite interesting, I think, that there has been a lot of pressure, actually, within my circles of science and technology studies for the repair of technologies, for sustainability. And I know Europe's been at the forefront of a lot of these, pushing for kind of repair. And in fact, sorry, I know I'm going on way too long, but no, I could just remember many years ago going to a conference, actually, on domestic technologies. It was actually on refrigerators and washing machines and these technologies, and actually trying to legislate, and I don't know whether this happened in Europe or not, but trying to make it the responsibility of manufacturers to deal with the old machines and the recycling and all of those things, a real kind of shift in sustainability for lots of technologies, including domestic technologies. Okay, on to my fourth point, which is about mobility justice. As you say in the manifesto, mobility impacts differently of groups, classes, sectors. I've spent a lot of my working life writing about the differences between groups who are able to control their time and groups who are unable to do so. If I can just give you two quick examples, there's been lots of fantastic research by geographers actually, looking at the journeys of working mothers with children. And what you find is that those journeys are very complicated, and that complexity is about, you know, the fact that a lot of public transport is actually about getting people to work directly and not making complicated journeys. And I remember in one of my very early books years ago, being very critical of cars, because of course we're all very critical of cars for all of the right reasons. And a working mother saying to me, actually, if you have to get a child to school, shop on the way, often go to the doctor and then get to work, try doing that without a car. So I think this point about how we reorganize transport to take these things into account. Again, the manifesto is spot on in terms of that. I recently read some fantastic research actually of a colleague of mine in Berkeley actually, who's done a lot of work on retirees and their time. And I know we tend to assume that retirees actually, that retirement is a great equalizer in a way, that being freed from the pressures of work, that there's suddenly an abundance of time. And actually what she found is that there's incredible difference in the temporal rhythms between wealthy retirees and the economically disadvantaged. She says, while the better off are focused on navigating an abundance of choices with regard to living a purposeful life and maintaining meaningful relationships with their highly mobile peers, in low-income neighborhoods, people are more concerned with surviving and supporting friends in need. Resource constraints limit their geographical mobility, and this is compounded by safety concerns. And this struck me as exactly an example of transport poverty and why it's very important to have that at the center. My very final point, it's really a fifth point, but I thought I could sneak in a fifth point, is really about how mobility justice has become even more key as a result of what's called within Europe the fourth industrial revolution. I have a lot of problems with that term, but I know this is, you know, standard usage here in Europe. And I think mobility justice has become even more important, not only because of increased inequality, but also because of the rise of the platform economy, or what we often talk about as gig work or platform work, which has algorithmic software at its core. And if there was ever a case of forced mobility, it's Uber drivers and food deliverers whose work is timed to the minute. It's Amazon workers rushing around in warehouses. So that seems to me at one end, there's a lot of this really forced mobility. At the other end, if you think about more privileged workers, I've currently been doing work on electronic calendars and their design in Silicon Valley. And all I mean by digital calendars are what you're all carrying around on your phone. You've all got digital calendars with you. And I carried out lots of interviews with the engineers who actually design this scheduling software. And what I found very interesting is that they really do believe, she says, they really do believe that artificial intelligence can turn these calendars into intelligent digital assistants that will do more and more tasks automatically. And that they will know us so well, because they collect so much data on us all the time, endless data, that they will know us so well that they'll be able to advise us even better on how to optimize our time. Now, apart from the fact that there's no way this technology is as good as they say there is, and I can tell you very funny anecdotes about how a lot of automated systems actually have behind them workers who are doing, you know, the invisible workers who are actually doing the stuff, you know, while it's presented as completely automated. I think the very notion, the ideas of these designers is that they're promoting really a linear quantitative accountant's orientation to time. And my point here, again, it's clearly stated in the manifesto, is that we need to resist the idea that technologies will perform better than humans, because it does risk, again, as the manifesto says, restricting human choices. The manifesto calls for more deliberative tools to assess transport policies. And I would extend this call to include the need for more deliberative policies around the design of technologies more generally. The rationale at the moment for much technological innovation reflects and feeds the culture of optimization and hyper-productivity. Indeed, the sheer speed of innovation is equated with inventiveness, productivity, and efficiency. And it's the ultimate measure of progress, as I think was has been mentioned before. And I think really we need to be much more critical and discriminating and deliberative about the kinds of technologies we want and the values and purposes they serve and could serve. And so I guess I'd just like to end by adding to Carl's list of slow things, we could have much slower science and technological innovation that was directed to better needs. Thank you.